I'm Sarah Schwartz-Sachs, and this is the Jamaica Plain Forum podcast, with community conversations on the great issues of the day. Visit us online at www.jamaicaplainforum.org to find out about upcoming events. And subscribe to our podcast to take us with you everywhere you go. The Jamaica Plain Forum is a program of the First Church in Jamaica Plain Unitarian Universalist and the Institute for Policy Studies. Podcast recorded and produced by David Goodman of the Independent Broadcast Information Service, ibisradio.org. Technical support for this podcast comes from the folks at quilted.org.
Figure out policies and strategies for taking back their communities and regrowing their local economies. And I had, having done this for a long time and traveled all parts of the country, had really developed this far-reaching sense of the impacts of these big retailers and what it has meant to lose our local businesses, as well as a sense of the growing grassroots rebellion out there against these companies, and the fact that lots of communities are taking very effective steps to reverse those trends. And so the book tells both of those stories equally. The first part of it is about the rise of the chains and their impact, and the second part is about what communities can and have done to reverse the tide. In the course of writing it, I interviewed over 200 business owners, local independent business owners around the country, and incorporated many of their stories into the book. One of them was a hardware store owner named Mike Castles, who had a hardware store in the town of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And this was a store that had been founded by his grandfather back in 1931, and he had inherited it through the generations. He had to close his store a few years ago, and when I talked with him, I asked him, you know, what was the hardest part about having to close your business? And he said it was laying off the employees. He had 20 people who worked there for them. They all made good wages, living wages, middle class wages in some cases. They all had full health benefits that he paid for. And some of them had been there for more than 40 years. They had actually been hired by his grandfather and had been at that business all of those years. Castles had to close his hardware store because in this town, Carlisle, which is about 25,000 people, the community had let in first a Home Depot and then a Walmart, and then there was word that they were going to let in a Lowe's. And this community simply couldn't absorb all of that new retail development without significant sales losses to local businesses. There just weren't that many dollars to go around. Castles Hardware was not the only business that closed. There were a number of other local businesses that also closed. And at the end of the day, this community ended up losing more jobs at those local stores than it gained at the new big box store. And that wasn't the only effect on the local economy. When the local retailers disappeared, they were no longer there to buy goods and services from other local businesses. They had been, you know, getting their printing done at the local print shop, and they'd hired the local accountants, and they'd just done all of this spending for various kinds of goods and services with other businesses in the community. The big boxes didn't need any of that. Studies have shown that as much as 85 cents of every dollar that you spend at a chain store actually leaves the local economy because they don't need any local goods and services. Dollars that go into those businesses head back to corporate headquarters. This is a story that has been repeated many times over in the last 15 or 20 years. Let me give you some of the dismal statistics. During the 1990s, we lost about 5,000 independent hardware stores in this country. Home Depot and Lowe's, which barely existed 20 years ago, now capture half of all hardware and building supply sales nationally. In 1998, not that long ago, the top five supermarket chains captured one out of every $4 that Americans spend on groceries. Today, the top five supermarket chains capture one out of every $2 that Americans spend on groceries. Between 1990 and 2002, half of all independent bookstores in this country closed. Barnes & Noble and Borders now capture about half of all book store spending in this country. And all the way through, restaurant spending has been increasingly in the hands of the Olive Garden and other chains like that. Target has grown eightfold in the last 15 years and now has about 1,500 massive stores nationwide. Every category, it seems, is now dominated by two or three companies, and Walmart dominates them all. Walmart is such a staggeringly huge corporation, it's sort of hard to get one's mind around just how big it is. Walmart captures one out of every $10 that Americans spend on everything. Walmart is the largest grocer in this country. They sell more jewelry, toys, clothing, home furnishings, and a host of other products than any other retailer. The thinking about this trend for the last 20 years or so is that this is progress. You might mourn the loss of your local bookstore, the neighborhood pharmacy, but these big companies are good for the economy, they're good for consumers, you can't get in the way of progress. But I think that there's quite a bit of evidence out there that these retailers have taken far more out of our economies than they put back in. We know conclusively from research done by an economist at the University of California that big box stores actually eliminate more retail jobs than they create. And that's because if you build a new retail store, you don't generate new consumer spending. The amount of spending in your community is a result of how many people live there and how many dollars do they have in their pockets. You can't increase that by building more retail. And so the result is that these retailers come in and they just divide the existing pie. Existing businesses close, they downsize, and you end up losing more jobs than you actually create. And it doesn't end there. As I mentioned in the context of Castle's Hardware, there are all of these dollars that get recirculated back in your local economy with locally owned stores. One of the things that I wanted to do with the book was to really look at how that works, to get beyond the studies and the numbers and to see how that plays out. And I interviewed community bankers and small town newspapers, publishers, and all of these businesses that, you know, we think about, yeah, the little retailers are hurt by the chains, but there have been all of these other kinds of businesses that have also been squeezed as the independent retailers disappear. I interviewed farmers like Russ Kramer, who's a fifth-generation pork farmer in Missouri, and who talked about how many of the farms in his area had disappeared because it used to be 20 years ago that you went to the market to sell your pork and there were lots of bidders for your product, and so you got a fair price. Now you go to the market, he says, and there's one bidder there, there's one meat processor, and they're the company that sells to Walmart, and things have become so consolidated that there's no longer any competition, and you can imagine what that has done for the price. I interviewed small manufacturers like Jamie Kreisman, who owns a wonderful toy company in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he said, you know, we've looked at selling to Walmart and Target, which are the biggest toy retailers in the country, but to do that, we would have to stop producing toys in St. Paul, and we would have to ship our production overseas. We would have to contract out to get the price down and to be able to do it in the way that they want it done. I said, you know, we don't want to lay off our employees. We've been in this community for a long time. We're a family-owned business. He is doing all right, but he and many other small manufacturers like him across the country can continue to exist only so long as there are independent retailers, because they're the place where those companies find shelf space for their products. The big box stores not only have no room for small manufacturers, but they have no room for domestic manufacturers, really, of any size. We've lost about 3 million manufacturing jobs in this country since 1990, and there are a number of reasons behind that, but Walmart, Home Depot, Target, these companies have played a significant role. They are in the power position in our economy now. They're the ones that drive decision-making, and it's pressure from those companies that has forced many consumer goods manufacturers to move to lower-wage countries. Home Depot and Lowe's, for example, pressured Black and Decker a few years ago, the toolmaker, and said, you've got to get your price down, you've got to move to a low-wage country, and they ended up laying off about 4,000 people and moving overseas. That's happened many, many times over across the country. What's scary for manufacturers who are in that position is that they're dealing with companies, you know, in the case of Home Depot and Lowe's, that not only have half the market, you give up half the market if you don't sell to them in their way, but they increasingly make their own products. Home Depot and Lowe's have their own lines of tools and other products, private label products. They contract directly with factories in China and India to have those made. And so when they're at the bargaining table with a company like Black & Decker, they're not only your biggest customer, but they're your biggest competitor. And if you don't do things their way, they'll not only find another supplier, but they may just start producing those goods themselves. About 20% of the products in a big box store on average are their own private label products. They may not say Walmart on the can. They may have developed a brand, but it is actually a Walmart manufactured product. In exchange for all the jobs that these companies have taken away, many middle-class jobs, key pillars of the American middle class, really small business owners, manufacturing workers, what these companies have given us instead are what are often very low-paying jobs with no benefits and no security working in their stores. I think we've seen this decline of the American middle class in the last 20 years. We've seen this rise statistically in the number of families that belong to the ranks of the working poor. And I think the Walmart economy has a lot to do with that trend. When I sort of finished looking at all of this and kind of tracing the ripple economic effects that go out, from retail through all of the other businesses, the manufacturers, the farmers, and watching what happens to the dollars. What emerged was a picture that doesn't really look at all like progress. It doesn't look like economic progress. It doesn't look like a recipe for prosperity at all. What it really looks like is colonialism. You know, it looks like those the kinds of economies that the European superpowers set up in Africa and other parts of the world, where the goal wasn't to enrich the local inhabitants. The goal was to extract and appropriate their resources. And I think in a sense that is really a very accurate metaphor for what happens to local economies as these chains move in. After I started thinking about the sort of colonialism as a metaphor for this, I also began to ask, well, what does that do to the social fabric of a community? What does it mean to democracy, essentially to be a colony of large corporations? And I went out looking and discovered that there are these sociologists at Cornell University and Baylor University, this group of sociologists who've been doing these really interesting studies where they look at, they compare, these big statistical analyses where they compare two groups of communities across the country that are identical in almost every respect in terms of the size, geography, all of those kinds of things, except they differ in one regard. One set of communities has an economy that is have economies that are predominantly made up of small local businesses, and the other set have economies that are really dominated by a handful of large corporations. And what they have found in those studies is that the economies that have lots of local businesses are far healthier on a variety of measures of social and civic health. They have lower crime rates, higher rates of home ownership. They have less income inequality, less poverty, and they also participate more in civic affairs. They, if you look, the people who live in those communities tend to belong to community organizations in much greater numbers. They go to city council meetings more often. They tend to be engaged in measurable ways to a much greater degree than people who live in similar communities, except that they have sort of big business economies. What accounts for this? I think that there are a number of reasons, and I spend a whole chapter in the book kind of teasing out what they are. One of the reasons, I think, has to do with the involvement of local business owners themselves in communities and the kind of role and investment that they make that's not only financial but often personal and very engaged in the local community. But another big reason, I think, has to do with essentially the way that we run our errands and how that either nurtures or undermines community. If the way that you run your errands is to walk go to a neighborhood, sort of traditional neighborhood business district or downtown in a small town, where you're walking, where you're going in and out of stores, where you're spending time on sidewalks, where you're running into your neighbors, where you're dealing with business owners who know you by name, perhaps, whose kids go to school with your kids, who have a connection to you and who live in the community. Those kinds of interactions and that way of running your errands builds the social fabric of the place that you live. It creates a sense of camaraderie and connection and ultimately, I think, a sense of responsibility for one another and really an eagerness to become involved in the place that you live and in the fabric of the community. Unfortunately, for a lot of Americans, that's not how their errands are run. They run their errands by getting in their car, driving several miles, usually alone, arriving at this vast parking lot. And if you hang out in a parking lot, if you hang out at Home Depot's parking lot and watch how people behave, you don't see any of that sort of meaningful loitering that you see on a main street. I mean, people don't, they make a beeline for the front door. They don't hang out and chat with one another. And then once you're inside that store, you're dealing with a store that's massive, that's really designed for commerce exclusively and not to support anything else, and that also is so large that it's really designed to serve a much larger region than a neighborhood. And what that means is that the person who's standing in front of you in line is very unlikely to be someone who lives in your neighborhood. It's not like shopping in a neighborhood business district where those people really are your neighbors. And so this is a model, you know, a lot of how we actually, if you think about how you spend your time day to day to day to day, a lot of how we experience our communities is through running our errands. And if the way that you experience your community is alone in your car, being in a parking lot, and then inside a Walmart, that is not something that's likely to build a sense of connection and build that web of social fabric that really nurtures the social and civic health of the places that we live. I think that this is, you know, all of this research that's been done is really quite striking and with enormous ramifications, and it's unfortunate that it hasn't gotten more attention. That way of, the big box way of running your errands is not only socially destructive, but it has huge environmental consequences. And I think some of the most startling statistics in the book are the statistics that I uncovered in doing research for the environmental section. And I wanted to particularly talk about these tonight because a lot of these companies are in the news now with various green initiatives. You know, Walmart's reducing the electricity, making its stores more energy efficient. Home Depot's got this labeling system for green products. And they're really making an effort to get a lot of sustainability headlines out there. And they've done a fairly good job of doing that. But there is an analysis where you step back and really look at the impact of their business model that's quite severe. Let me give you a few of these statistics. Between 1990 and 2001, the number of miles that the average American household drove just for shopping grew by more than 40%. For the country as a whole, that's an extra 100 billion miles on the road every year just for shopping, over 1990 levels, which of course was a time when we were already driving a lot. One of the questions you might ask about that is, well, are we going to the store more often? Are we somehow taking more trips to the store? Is that what is causing this? And the answer is no. We're taking about the same number of trips in our cars for shopping that we did. It's just that each of those trips is about 2 miles longer than it used to be. And you might say, well, you know, maybe it's just part of the whole suburbanization trend. People are moving outside of cities, continue to sprawl outward. People are driving more for a whole lot of reasons. And that's true. Driving overall has gone up. But shopping-related driving has grown 3 times as fast as driving for all other purposes. There's something else going on here besides the larger trends. The culprit really is the big box stores, because what has happened is not only have they chosen locations that are often accessible only by car, that may be removed and outside on the edges of towns, but they've also effectively aggregated larger regions of shoppers, because what has happened, just to give you an example, Remember I mentioned that in the 1990s, in that decade, we lost about 5,000 independent hardware stores. Those were stores that were scattered across about as many neighborhoods. And those stores during that decade were replaced by 1,500 Home Depot and Lowe's supercenters. And if you think about what that means, it means for most people, that meant that they had to drive a little bit further to get a hammer or pick up a gallon of paint because these stores were serving larger geographic areas. And so the consequence of all of this has been this dramatic rise in the number of miles that we're driving for shopping. All of it adds up to about 40 million metric tons of additional CO2 going into the atmosphere over 1990 levels. The other really striking piece of the environmental impact of these stores has been the land consumption. Between 1990 and 2005, the amount of square footage store, retail store space square footage per person in this country doubled. We now have about five or six times as much retail store space per person as folks in Western Europe. And the land binge associated with that, now if you think about it, back in 1990, as I recall, we had plenty of shopping options in this country. There were already lots of malls, lots of other kinds of retail developments. It's doubled since then. And the land binge is even worse than it sounds, because for every square foot of store space that we built in that time, we also built 3 to 4 square feet of parking lot. These retailers have consumed an enormous amount of land. And it's not that we actually need all of that retail or can even support it. The growth in retail space was not in response to an increase in consumer spending. Median household incomes over that period grew about 10%, adjusted for inflation. Meanwhile, the amount of retail space exploded 100%. What is going on is this kind of development arms race, as these companies and the developers go out there and try to build bigger and bigger outlets, not only to steal market share from existing businesses, local retailers, but to outcompete one another in this kind of game. One of the consequences of that has been this explosion of retail vacancy. We not only have lots of empty storefronts in our neighborhoods and in our downtowns, but we now have almost 200 dead malls in this country, big enclosed malls that are currently sitting empty. We have thousands of empty strip shopping centers, you know, those kind that have the grocery store on one end and a bunch of smaller outlets, lots of those sitting empty. And we have thousands of empty big box stores, some of them the result of big box retailers that failed, but most of them the result of big box retailers that succeeded. You know, over 300 empty Walmarts right now across the country, often because Walmart abandoned a store that's 10 years old to build one twice as large across the road or a mile down the street. All of these companies are doing this, and it's just chewing up land and resources and paving over the country, ultimately at the end of the day, for no gain to our economies at all, but rather for a hollowing out of the economic health of the places that we live. The CO2 emissions associated with all of this are far, far greater than the CO2 emissions associated with the energy use in their stores and the other kinds of things that Walmart wants to talk about with regard to its environmental footprint right now. Yes, it's great to be more efficient in terms of energy use, but that's small potatoes compared to the real issue, which has to do with land use and transportation and what it is that they've done to the way that we get around in our communities and the way that we meet our day-to-day needs. Rebuilding our local economies would deliver significant benefits economically, environmentally, and socially. I also think it's a really important part of sustaining and nurturing a diverse culture and a rich consumer experience. I'm really nervous and concerned about the idea of these small numbers of retailers deciding what gets manufactured, how it gets manufactured, where it gets what's available, what kind of products are available to us. And it's a particular concern in the context of books and music and film and other works of free expression when we have companies like Barnes & Noble and Borders and Amazon who control such a large share of the book selling universe out there and really effectively decide what it is, have a tremendous amount of power with regard to publishers and what it is that, that can get published in this country. Perhaps the most scandalous aspect of this whole issue is that we have gotten here not solely because of consumer choices. One of the things that we always hear is that the rise of these companies is simply a matter of people choosing where to shop. That's where they're spending their dollars. It's simply a matter of the free market, right? But to a scandalous degree, Walmart, Home Depot, Barnes & Noble have risen to dominance because of government policy. Every year in this country, cities and counties provide hundreds of millions of dollars in development subsidies for big box stores. This is when Target comes into a community and says, we want to build a store here and we're going to create all these jobs and all this tax revenue. Never mind if that's really true. But they come in and they sell that to a community and they say, but the only way we're going to do it is if you give us a $7 million tax break. All of these guys do this and they go all around the country picking up these subsidies everywhere that they go. One study found that Walmart has received over $1 billion in development subsidies just in the last few years. Meanwhile, even if your community doesn't give away those kinds of subsidies, the retailers that expand here, the chains that come here, are able to do that in part because of all the public funding that they've picked up everywhere else. Our independent retailers never get those kinds of subsidies. I mean, if you have an idea for a business and you go down to your city council and you say, will you give me, $100,000 to start this store? Will you give me a big tax break? And you're going to be laughed out of the room, and they're going to explain to you about the free market, and you've got to compete and sink or swim on your own. Meanwhile, you're out there competing in this so-called free market against companies who have gotten these huge subsidies. That isn't the only way that public policy has tilted the playing field. There are all kinds of examples that I covered in doing research for the book. Another big one, and one that's quite relevant here in Massachusetts, is that about half the states, and Massachusetts is one of them, have this glaring loophole in their state corporate tax policies. And essentially, this is a loophole. It's actually nicknamed the Jeffrey loophole, after Jeffrey the giraffe, the Toys R Us mascot, because Toys R Us was the first one to sort of discover and exploit it, but now all of these big retailers do it. And what it does, I won't bore you with the mechanics of it, but essentially it enables a company that operates across multiple states to escape paying all or part of their state income taxes in 20-some states across the country. They can move it around on paper and get out of having that liability. That happens here in Massachusetts. Meanwhile, if you're an independent business and you have only one store in one state, you have to pay taxes on 100% of your earnings. Tremendously tilted playing field. The good news in all of this, and I guess the last thing I would say about the public policy stuff is it's just really, in a country where you've got every politician, whether you're Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter what part of the political spectrum, they all go on about the value of small business, right, and what that means. And yet there's this huge gap between rhetoric and reality, and we really need to address that. The good news is that there are a lot of communities out there, and really it has exploded just in the last few years. It used to be communities out there that are reversing the trends, that are saying no to big box stores, that are adopting really innovative policies and developing campaigns that are very effective. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of those, and the whole second half of the book is about them. It used to be when I first started working on this issue 8 or so years ago, or even just 4 or 5 years ago, I could kind of keep up with what was going on around the country, all the places where there was some citizens group trying to keep a Walmart out, or some small business organization working to get rid of these subsidies. I could keep track of all of them. Because there weren't that many, that it was beyond one person. Now it is. I mean, I can't possibly keep track of everything that's going on out there because there is so much happening at the local level, and it's really quite encouraging. Last year, to tell you one quick story from my own home state of Maine, In Damariscotta, which is a village of about 2,000 people along the coast, it's about an hour and a half north of Portland, there was this rumor in town that Walmart wanted to build a 200,000-square-foot supercenter. That's a store of about 4 football fields in size in this village of 2,000 people. Some people dismissed that rumor. They thought, that's crazy. Why would they want to come here? Well, what's happening is that these retailers have to continue to grow. And as they've exhausted a lot of the more obvious locations, they're going into smaller and smaller communities, and they're also trying very hard to get into urban neighborhoods. And indeed, it turned out that this rumor was true. Walmart had, in fact, set its sights on locating in Damariscotta. Two women, stay-at-home moms in Damariscotta, Eleanor Kenny and Jenny Mayer, got wind of this rumor and decided that they were going to do something about it. And they organized a community meeting and had about 80 people come out. They were quite surprised. And they formed this organization called Our Town Damariscotta. And they began to advocate that not only should the town say no to Walmart, but the town should ban big box stores and do that by enacting an ordinance that would prohibit any retail stores over 35,000 square feet, about a sixth the size of the proposed Walmart. Walmart didn't take this campaign lying down. They ended up spending over $100,000 in this little village. You know, everybody got these really slick mailings in their mailboxes, and the PR firms coming in, the whole bit. And that didn't work, fortunately. The grassroots group continued its campaign, kept its message positive, and that didn't gain any traction. And then Walmart said, well, okay, we think we have the trump card. If you won't let us into Damariscotta, we're going to build our store right across your town borders in a neighboring community. And you're going to have absolutely no control over anything at that point, what the store looks like, anything else. You either let us in or we're going to do exactly the same damage to your economy right across the border. Fortunately, that backfired, because when people in those neighboring communities got wind of that, they started organizing and advocating. And last spring, not only did voters in Damariscotta overwhelmingly approve the big box ban, but it swept up the coast, and we now have this region, this little region of Maine, where there's no big box allowed, because all of these communities have adopted similar kinds of ordinances. It's a great story, and fortunately, it's not an anomaly. Cities and towns across the country, about 200 just in the last few years, have fought successfully to keep big box retailers and other kinds of chain developments out. Here are the kinds of things that I think we need to do to move this forward and to begin to implement proactive changes that are about more than just saying no to these retailers, but really setting up long-term kinds of policy changes. One is that I think we have to recognize this as a policy issue. But we need to get past the kind of debate that often goes on in the media that this is just simply about consumer choices, and to say, no, public policy plays a major role in this, and we need to tackle that head on. That's already begun at the local level. There are hundreds of communities that have adopted store size caps, that have said no to big box stores. There are others that have put in place economic impact review requirements, where you can't just come into a community and open a new retail development without there being an analysis of how that's going to impact the town and the town having the power to say no. Lots of that kind of activity, using local zoning and planning tools effectively across the country. And this is beginning to, what started out as a really widespread local effort is now beginning to bubble up to the state level. As Chuck mentioned, we passed last week, and the governor signed what is, I think, a landmark bill nationally in the state of Maine. And what the bill does is it requires communities to do economic impact studies for anything over 75,000 square feet. So from now on, there is no part of Maine where a developer can come in and just put a big box store in. If you want to build something of that scale, there has to be an independent analysis of how is this going to affect existing retailers, jobs, wages. What is it going to cost to provide all these public services? You know, we often think these stores are going to be a boon in terms of tax revenue. There are a lot of communities that have found that when you look at all of the additional costs that go along with them, plus the losses from the downtown, you actually end up with a net loss to local finances. Excuse me. So now in Maine, these kinds of studies will have to be done. And what's important about the law is that not only does it say that there has to be studies done, but there's now a standard in Maine land use statutes. And what that does is it gives communities the authority to turn down one of these projects on economic grounds. The other standards that are in Maine land use law have to do with environmental issues, wetlands, traffic, those kinds of things. Now there's an economic impact standard, and we're really saying economics has to be a part of development decisions. One of the key lessons in passing that bill was the coalition that worked on it included my organization and a group called the Maine Fair Trade Campaign, which is made up of labor unions, faith groups, environmental organizations from all across the state. And the other, so that was sort of the core coalition. One of the things we knew early on was that sort of big business interests in the state would come out and attempt to paint this bill as anti-business, that it was going to harm business development in the state, it was going to hurt the state's economy. And the way that we overcame that is we went out and organized about 180 small business owners across the state. And we had to do this sort of door-to-door because there is no small business organization in Maine. The Maine State Chamber of Commerce, which has a lot of small business owners in its membership, and whenever it speaks to the legislature, brings them up. But in fact, if you really look at what they do, they're very much dominated by their big business members, and they took a position against this bill. The Maine Merchants Association, which includes Target, Walmart, and all those big guys, also has a bunch of independent retailers as members, but when they came to the State House and took a position on this bill, they opposed it based on the opposition of the big guys. So we had to really go out and build that constituency of small business owners ourselves. And they came to the State House, they testified, they wrote letters, they gave comments in the media, and it was really crucial because it changed the idea that this was an anti-business bill. And instead the debate became, what kind of economy do we want? Not are we going to have no economic growth, but what kind of economic growth do we want to have in the state of Maine? And that made all of the difference and you brought really key lawmakers, both Democrat and Republicans, over to our side and made this this bill happen. I understand that there is a growing effort here in this state to get rid of the loophole that I mentioned that allows big businesses, big retailers to escape their income tax liability. And part of that effort is recruiting independent business owners to help to make that case and to be part of that coalition. And I think this is really going to be a key strategy in that campaign and in many others across the country. There really has been not much in the way of an organized voice for small businesses out there, and we need to change that. So policy is one of the big areas that we need to tackle, and there are two others. The second one is economic development programs. Right now, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars every year at the local level subsidizing Target and Walmart and Lowe's and Home Depot and all of these guys. What if we took some of that money and said no to those kinds of subsidies and began to funnel resources into neighborhood and downtown revitalization efforts and into generating a new generation of local businesses? What is it that local business owners, entrepreneurs need to get started and to be successful? I went out and doing research for the book and found examples of all sorts of interesting programs, incubators, retail incubators that have rebuilt neighborhood business districts that were once vacant, mentorship programs that have successfully paired veteran entrepreneurs with young people who are just getting started and have helped develop all of these new small businesses that way. There are a lot of ideas out there. The problem is that we've not had the political will and the resources put behind them, and we need to do that. And lastly, I think the third level of thing that we need to do is we really need to build public awareness of this issue. I mean, a lot of people don't think about where they shop and how those choices influence the economy and all of the ramifications of that decision. By far the most effective efforts that I've seen out there that to change the choices that people make have been by local campaigns that have started up at about 40 cities around the country in the last few years. And these are campaigns typically that are run by coalitions of independent business owners, sometimes by an existing Main Street organization or an existing local business group, sometimes by a new alliance of independent businesses that comes together specifically around this idea. We started a campaign in Portland, Maine, where I live, about a year ago. Actually, right now is our one-year anniversary. And we have about 225 independent businesses who are part of it, bookstores, hardware, grocers. Our slogan is buy local, keep Portland independent. And what you'll see if you walk around Portland is that these decals are on storefront windows across town. We have them on bumper stickers, T-shirts, tote bags. And we do a lot of posters. We did a sort of 10 reasons why locally owned businesses matter, and we put a different reason on 10 different posters. So as you walk around town, you'll see reason number 3 and reason number 5. We've done a lot of good work in the media. We do all kinds of things to give the local press a kind of angle on this issue and get them to turn out, and so we get covered in the local television news all the time and in the local paper. And all of those times are opportunities for reporters to stick a microphone in front of a local business owner and for them to be able to talk about the fact that, hey, if you shop at a local store, a lot more of your dollar stays in the economy that supports jobs and businesses here in Maine, as opposed to something like Walmart, or to talk about the environmental issues or whatever. It's always using the media as an opportunity to get the message out there. The campaign has been fairly successful. We did a survey earlier in the year and found that a significant large percentage of our business owners, about two-thirds, reported that it had a positive impact, a noticeable positive impact on their business, that they had customers who were calling and asking if they were locally owned before they came in, or who were coming into their store talking about the campaign. We had a bookstore owner, one of the many anecdotes that he told me was about a woman who came in and said, "You know, I'm a new customer here." And he said, "Well, you know, Portland's not very big." He said, "How long did you just move to town?" And she said, "No, I've been here for 20 years." She's been buying books out at the mall at Borders or buying them online at Amazon.com. But she had been in other local stores that she shopped in, and she'd picked up our literature and she'd read the stuff, and she had said, "You know, I'm going to start shopping at this local bookstore from now on." And we're hearing that from all of our business members, that it's really influenced what people do. There are two national organizations that help communities and help business groups start these kinds of campaigns and can tell you sort of what works and what doesn't work and can give you all of the kind of how-to stuff. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can really take a lot of this right off of from what other people have done. One group is the American Independent Business Alliance, with I'm on their board, which is an umbrella group for about 36 of these campaigns around the country. And the other is the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which I'm also somewhat affiliated with. And they have groups, again, that are doing Shop Local First campaigns around the country, and both organizations have lots and lots of how-to resources. So I really appreciate you coming out on such a warm evening and listening to me talk. And I believe, do you want to turn it over to Shane now?
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
That was terrific. Thank you very much.